Good evening. Welcome to the Just Sleep Podcast. I'm Tayshia, your host. Every week, I will read you an old story to help you relax, put the stressful day behind you, and drift off to sleep. Occasionally, we will run ads in order to cover the costs of the production of the podcast. Rest assured, there will be no ads during or after the story. If you prefer an ad-free and intro-free show, you can join Just Sleep Premium. Visit justsleeppodcast.com/support for more information.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tonight, I continue the story, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte. So lie down. Close your eyes and let me read you a story. Chapter 10. When all were gone, I learnt that the vile slander had indeed been circulated throughout the company in the very presence of the victim. Rose, however, vowed she did not and would not believe it. And my mother made the same declaration, though not, I fear, with the same amount of real, unwavering incredulity. It seemed to dwell continually on her mind, and she kept irritating me from time to time by such expressions as, "Dear, dear, who would have thought it? Well, I always thought there was something odd about her." You see what it is for women to affect to be different to other people. And once it was, "I misdoubted that appearance of mystery from the very first. I thought there would be no good come of it. But this is a sad, sad business, to be sure." "Why, mother? You said you didn't believe these tales," said Fergus. "No more I do, my dear. But then, you know, there must be some foundation." "The foundation is in the wickedness and falsehood of the world," said I. "And in the fact that Mr. Lawrence has been seen to go that way once or twice of an evening. And the village gossips say he goes to paste addresses to the strange lady. But the scandalmongers have greedily seized the rumour to make it the basis of their own infernal structure." "Well, but Gilbert, there must be something in her manner to countenance such reports."
"Did you see anything in her manner?"
"No, certainly, but then, you know, I've always said there was something strange about her." I believe it was on that very evening that I ventured on another invasion of Wildfell Hall. From the time of our party, which was upwards of a week ago, I had been making daily efforts to meet its mistress in her walks, and always disappointed, she must have managed it so on purpose, had nightly kept revolving in my mind some pretext for another call. At length, I concluded that the separation could be endured no longer. By this time, you see, I was pretty far gone. And taking from the bookcase an old volume that I thought she might be interested in, though from its unsightly and somewhat dilapidated condition, I had not yet ventured to offer it for perusal. I hastened away, but not without sundry misgivings as to how she would receive me, or how I could summon courage to present myself with so slight an excuse. But perhaps I might see her in the field or the garden, and then there would be no great difficulty. It was the formal knocking at the door with the prospect of being gravely ushered in by Rachel to the presence of a surprised, uncordial mistress that so greatly disturbed me. My wish, however,
was not gratified. Mrs. Graham herself was not to be seen, but there was Arthur playing with his frolicsome little dog in the garden. I looked over the gate and called him to me. He wanted me to come in, but I told him I could not without his mother's leave. "I'll go and ask her," said the child. "No, no, Arthur, you mustn't do that. But if she's not engaged, just ask her to come here a minute. Tell her I want to speak to her." He ran to perform my bidding and quickly returned with his mother. How lovely she looked, with her dark ringlets streaming in the light summer breeze, her fair cheek slightly flushed, and her countenance radiant with smiles. "Dear Arthur, what did I not owe to you for this and every other happy meeting?" Through him I was at once delivered from all formality and terror and constraint. In love affairs, there's no mediator like a merry, simple-hearted child, ever ready to cement divided hearts, to span the unfriendly gulf of custom, to melt the ice of cold reserve, and overthrow the separating walls of dread formality and pride. "Well, Mr. Markham, what is it?" said the young mother, accosting me with a pleasant smile. "I want you to look at this book, and if you please to take it and peruse it at your leisure. I make no apology for calling you out on such a lovely evening, though it be for a matter of no greater importance." "Tell him to come in, Mama," said Arthur. "Would you like to come in?" asked the lady. "Yes, I should like to see your improvements in the garden. And how your sister's roots have prospered in my charge," added she as she opened the gate. And we sauntered through the garden and talked of the flowers, the trees, and the book, and then of other things. The evening was kind and genial, and so was my companion. By degrees I waxed more warm and tender than perhaps I'd ever been before. But still I said nothing tangible, and she attempted no repulse until, in passing a moss rose tree that I had brought her some weeks since, in my sister's name, she plucked a beautiful half-open bud and bade me give it to Rose. "May I not keep it myself?" I asked. "No. But here's another for you." Instead of taking it quietly, I likewise took the hand that offered it and looked into her face. She let me hold it for a moment, and I saw a flash of ecstatic brilliance in her eye, a glow of glad excitement on her face. I thought my hour of victory was come, but instantly a painful recollection seemed to flash upon her. A cloud of anguish darkened her brow. A marble paleness blanched her cheek and lip. There seemed a moment of inward conflict, and with a sudden effort, she withdrew her hand and retreated a step or two back. "Now, Mr. Markham," said she, with a kind of desperate calmness, "I must tell you plainly that I cannot do with this. I like your company, because I am alone here, and your conversation pleases me more than that of any other person. But if you cannot be content to regard me as a friend, a plain, cold, motherly or sisterly friend, I must beg you to leave me now and let me alone hereafter. In fact, we must be strangers for the future." "I will, then, be your friend or brother or anything you wish, if you will only let me continue to see you. But tell me, why I cannot be anything more?" There was a perplexed and thoughtful pause. "Is it in consequence of some rash avowal?" "It is something of the kind," she answered. "Someday, I may tell you, but at present, you had better leave me. And never, Gilbert, put me to the painful necessity of repeating what I have just now said to you," she earnestly added, giving me her hand in serious kindness. How sweet, how musical my own name sounded in her mouth. "I will not," I replied. "Would you pardon this offense?" "On condition that you never repeat it. And may I come to see you, now and then?" "Perhaps, occasionally, provided you never abuse the privilege." "I make no empty promises, but you shall see." "The moment you do, our intimacy is at an end, that's all." "And will you always call me Gilbert? It sounds more sisterly, and it will serve to remind me of our contract." She smiled, and once more bid me go. And at length I judged it prudent to obey, and she re-entered the house, and I went down the hill. But as I went, the tramp of horses' hoofs fell on my ear and broke the stillness of the dewy evening, and looking towards the lane I saw a solitary equestrian coming up.
Inclining to dusk as it was, I knew him at a glance. It was Mr. Lawrence on his grey pony. I flew across the field, leaped the stone fence, and then walked down the lane to meet him. On seeing me, he suddenly drew in his little steed and seemed inclined to turn back, but on second thought, apparently judged it better to continue his course as before. He accosted me with a slight bow and, edging close to the wall, endeavoured to pass on, but I was not so minded. Seizing his horse by the bridle, I exclaimed, "Now, Lawrence, I will have this mystery explained. Tell me where you are going and what you mean to do at once and distinctly." "Will you take your hand off the bridle?" said he quietly. "You're hurting my pony's mouth." "You and your pony be, what makes you so coarse and brutal, Markham? I'm quite ashamed of you. You answer my questions. Before you leave this spot, I will know what you mean by this perfidious duplicity." "I shall answer no questions till you let go the bridle. If you stand till morning." "Now then," said I, unclosing my hand, but still standing before him. "Ask me some other time, when you can speak like a gentleman," returned he. And he made an effort to pass me again. But I quickly recaptured the pony, scarce less astonished than its master at such uncivil usage. "Really, Markham, this is too much," said the latter. "Can I not go to see my tenant on matters of business without being assaulted in this manner by—" "This is no time for business, sir. I'll tell you now what I think of your conduct." "You'd better defer your opinion to a more convenient season," interrupted he in a low tone. "Here's the vicar." And in truth, the vicar was just behind me, plodding homeward from some remote corner of his parish. I immediately released the squire, and he went on his way, saluting Mr. Millward as he passed. "What? Quarrelling, Markham?" cried the latter, addressing himself to me. "And about that young widow, I doubt," he added, reproachfully shaking his head. "But let me tell you, young man," here he put his face into mine with an important, confidential air, "she's not worth it." And he confirmed the assertion by a solemn nod. "Mr. Millward," I exclaimed, in a tone of wrathful menace that made the reverend gentleman look round, aghast, astounded at such unwanted insolence, and stare me in the face with a look that plainly said, "What? This to me?" But I was too indignant to apologize or to speak another word to him. I turned away and hastened homewards, descending with rapid strides the steep, rough lane, and leaving him to follow as he pleased. Chapter 11. You must suppose about 3 weeks passed over. Mrs. Graham and I were now established friends, or brother and sister, as we rather chose to consider ourselves. She called me Gilbert, by my express desire, and I called her Helen, for I had seen that name written in her books. I seldom attempted to see her above twice a week, and still I made our meetings appear the result of accident as often as I could, for I found it necessary to be extremely careful, and altogether I behaved with such exceeding propriety that she never had occasion to reprove me once. Yet I could not but perceive that she was at times unhappy and dissatisfied with herself or her position. And I truly myself was not quite contented with the latter. This assumption of brotherly nonchalance was very hard to sustain, and I often felt myself a most confounded hypocrite with it all. I saw too, or rather I felt, that, in spite of herself, I was not indifferent to her, as the novel heroes modestly express it. And while I thankfully enjoyed my present good fortune, I could not fail to wish and hope for something better in the future. But, of course, I kept such dreams entirely to myself. "Where are you going, Gilbert?" said Rose one evening shortly after tea, when I had been busy with the farm all day. "To take a walk," was the reply. "Do you always brush your hat so carefully and do your hair so nicely, and put on such smart new gloves when you take a walk?" "Not always." "You're going to Wildfell Hall, aren't you?" "What makes you think so?" "Because you look as if you were. But I wish you wouldn't go so often." "Nonsense, child. I don't go once in 6 weeks. What do you mean?" "Well, but if I were you, I wouldn't have so much to do with Mrs. Graham." "Why, Rose, are you too given in to the prevailing opinion?" "No," returned she hesitatingly. "But I've heard so much about her lately, both at the Wilsons and the vicarage, and besides, Mama says if she were a proper person, she would not be living there by herself. And don't you remember last winter, Gilbert? All that about the false name to the picture and how she explained it? Saying she had friends or acquaintances from whom she wished her present residence to be concealed, and that she was afraid of their tracing her out. And then, how suddenly she started up and left the room when that person came, whom she took good care not to let us catch a glimpse of, and who Arthur, with such an air of mystery, told us was his mamma's friend. Yes, Rose, I remember it all, and I can forgive your uncharitable conclusions, for perhaps if I did not know her myself, I should put all these things together and believe the same as you do. But thank God I do know her, and I should be unworthy the name of a man if I could believe anything that was said against her, unless I heard it from her own lips. I should as soon believe such things of you, Rose. Oh, Gilbert. Well, do you think I could believe anything of the kind, whatever the Wilsons and Millwards dare to whisper? I should hope not, indeed. And why not? Because I know you. And I know her just as well. Oh, no. You know nothing of her former life. And last year, at this time, you did not know that such a person existed. No matter. There is such a thing as looking through a person's eyes into the heart, and learning more of the height and breadth and depth of another's soul in 1 hour than it might take you a lifetime to discover if he or she were not disposed to reveal it, or if you had not the sense to understand it. Then you are going to see her this evening? To be sure I am. But what would Mama say, Gilbert? Mama needn't know. But she must know sometime, if you go on. Go on? There's no going on in the matter. Mrs. Graham and I are two friends, and will be, and no man breathing shall hinder it, or has a right to interfere between us. But if you knew how they talk, you would be more careful, for her sake as well as for your own. Jane Wilson thinks your visits to the old hall but another proof of her depravity. Confound Jane Wilson. And Eliza Millward is quite grieved about you. I hope she is. But I wouldn't, if I were you. Wouldn't what? How do they know that I go there? There's nothing hid from them. They spy out everything. Oh, I never thought of this. And so they dare to turn my friendship into food for further scandal against her? That proves the falsehood of their other lies, at all events, if any proof were wanting. Mind you contradict them, Rose, whenever you can. But they don't speak openly to me about such things. It is only by hints and innuendos, and by what I hear others say, that I knew what they think. Well then, I won't go today. It's getting quite latish. But oh, deuce take their cursed and venomed tongues, I muttered, in the bitterness of my soul. And just at that moment the vicar entered the room. We had been too much absorbed in our conversation to observe his knock. After his customary cheerful and fatherly greeting of Rose, who was rather a favourite with the old gentleman, he turned somewhat sternly to me. "Well, sir," said he, "you're quite a stranger. It is... Let me see," he continued slowly, as he deposited his ponderous bulk in the armchair that Rose officiously brought towards him. "It is just 6 weeks, by my reckoning, since you darkened my door." He spoke with emphasis and struck his stick on the floor. "Is it, sir?" said I. "Aye, it is so." He added an affirmatory nod and continued to gaze upon me with a kind of irate solemnity, holding his substantial stick between his knees with his hands clasped upon his head. "I have been busy," I said, for an apology was evidently demanded. "Busy?" repeated he, derisively. "Yes, you know I've been getting in my hay, and now the harvest is beginning." Just then, my mother came in, and created a diversion in my favour by her loquacious and animated welcome of the reverend guest. She regretted deeply that he had not come a little earlier, in time for tea, but offered to have some immediately prepared if he would do the favour to partake of it. "Not any for me, I thank you," replied he. "I shall be at home in a few minutes." "Oh, but do stay and take a little. It will be ready in 5 minutes." But he rejected the offer with a majestic wave of the hand. "I'll tell you what I'll take, Mrs. Markham," said he. "I'll take a glass of your excellent ale." "With pleasure," cried my mother, proceeding with alacrity to pull the bell and ordered the favoured beverage. I thought, continued he, I'd just look in upon you as I passed and taste your home-brewed ale. I've been to call on Mrs. Graham.
Have you indeed?
He nodded gravely and added with awful emphasis, I thought it incumbent upon me to do so.
Really? Ejaculated my mother.
Why so, Mr. Millward? Asked I. He looked at me with some severity, and turning again to my mother, repeated, I thought it incumbent upon me, and he struck his stick on the floor again. My mother sat opposite, an awe-struck but admiring auditor. Mrs. Graham, said I, he continued, shaking his head as he spoke, these are terrible reports.
What, sir? Says she, affecting to be ignorant of my meaning.
It is my duty, as your pastor, said I, to tell you both everything that I myself see reprehensible in your conduct, and all I have reason to suspect, and what others tell me concerning you. So I told her.
You did, sir? Cried I, starting from my seat and striking my fist on the table.
He merely glanced towards me and continued, addressing his hostess. It was a painful duty, Mrs. Markham, but I told her.
And how did she take it? Answered my mother.
Hardened, I fear hardened, he replied, with a despondent shake of the head. And at the same time there was a strong display of unchastened, misdirected passions. She turned white in the face and drew her breath through her teeth in a savage sort of way. But she offered no extenuation or defense, and with a kind of shameless calmness, shocking indeed to witness in one so young, as good as told me that my remonstrance was unavailing, and my pastoral advice quite thrown away upon her. Nay, that my very presence was displeasing while I spoke such things. And I withdrew at length, too plainly seeing that nothing could be done, and sadly grieved to find her case so hopeless. But I am fully determined, Mrs. Markham, that my daughters shall not consort with her.
Do you adopt the same resolution with regards to yours? As for your sons?
As for you, young man, he continued, sternly turning to me.
As for me, sir, I began, but checked by some impediment in my utterance, and finding that my whole frame trembled with fury, I said no more.
I took the wiser part of snatching up my hat and bolting from the room, slamming the door behind me, with a bang that shook the house to its foundations and made my mother scream, and gave a momentary relief to my excited feelings. The next minute saw me hurrying with rapid strides in the direction of Wildfell Hall. To what intent or purpose I could scarcely tell, but I must be moving somewhere, and no other goal would do. I must see her, too, and speak to her, that was certain. But what to say, or how to act, I had no definite idea. Such stormy thoughts, so many different resolutions crowded in upon me, and my mind was little better than a chaos of conflicting passions.
Chapter 12. In little more than 20 minutes, the journey was accomplished. I paused at the gate to wipe my streaming forehead and recover my breath and some degree of composure. Already the rapid walking had somewhat mitigated my excitement, and with a firm and steady tread I paced the garden walk. In passing the inhabited wing of the building, I caught sight of Mrs. Graham through the open window, slowly pacing up and down her lonely room. She seemed agitated and even dismayed at my arrival, as if she thought I too was coming to accuse her. I had entered her presence intending to condole with her upon the wickedness of the world and help her to abuse the vicar and his vile informants, but now I felt positively ashamed to mention the subject and determined not to refer to it unless she led the way. "I am come at an unseasonable hour," said I, assuming a cheerfulness I did not feel, in order to reassure her. "But I won't stay many minutes." She smiled upon me, faintly, it is true, but most kindly. I had almost said thankfully, as her apprehensions were removed. "How dismal you are, Helen. Why have you no fire?" I said, looking round on the gloomy apartment. "It is summer yet," she replied. "But we always have a fire in the evenings, if we can bear it. And you especially require one in this cold house and dreary room. You should have come a little sooner, and I would have had one lighted for you, but it is not worthwhile now." "You won't stay many minutes, you say,"
and Arthur is going to bed. But I have a fancy for a fire, nevertheless. Will you order one, if I ring? Why, Gilbert, you don't look cold, said she, smilingly regarding my face, which no doubt seemed warm enough. No, replied I, but I want to see you comfortable before I go. Me, comfortable, repeated she with a bitter laugh, as if there were something amusingly absurd in the idea. It suits me better as it is, she added, in a tone of mournful resignation. But determined to have my own way, I pulled the bell. There now, Helen, I said, as the approaching steps of Rachel were heard in answer to the summons. There was nothing for it but to turn round and desire the maid to light the fire. I owe Rachel a grudge to this day for the look she cast upon me ere she departed on her mission, the sour, suspicious, inquisitorial look that plainly demanded, "What are you here for, I wonder?" Her mistress did not fail to notice it, and a shade of uneasiness darkened her brow. "You must not stay long, Gilbert," said she, when the door was closed upon us. "I'm not going to," said I, somewhat testily, though without a grain of anger in my heart against anyone but the meddling old woman. "But, Helen, I have something to say to you before I go." "What is it?" "No, not now. I don't know yet precisely what it is, or how to say it," replied I, with more truth than wisdom. And then, fearing lest she should turn me out of the house, I began talking about indifferent matters in order to gain time. Meanwhile, Rachel came in to kindle the fire, which was soon effected by thrusting a red-hot poker between the bars of the grate, where the fuel was already disposed for ignition. She honored me with another of her hard, inhospitable looks in departing, but little moved thereby, I went on talking, and setting a chair for Mrs. Graham on one side of the hearth and one for myself on the other, I ventured to sit down, though half suspecting she would rather see me go. In a little while we both relapsed into silence, and continued for several minutes gazing abstractedly into the fire, she intent upon her own sad thoughts, and I reflecting how delightful it would be to be seated thus beside her, with no other presence to restrain our intercourse, not even that of Arthur, our mutual friend, without whom we would never have met before. If only I could venture to speak my mind and disburden my full heart of the feelings that had so long oppressed it, and which it now struggled to retain, with an effort that it seemed impossible to continue much longer, and revolving the pros and cons for opening my heart to her there and then, and imploring a return of affection, the permission to regard her thenceforth as my own, and the right and the power to defend her from the calumnies of malicious tongues. On the one hand, I felt a newborn confidence in my powers of persuasion, a strong conviction that my own fervor of spirit would grant me eloquence, that my very determination, the absolute necessity for succeeding, that I felt must win me what I sought. While on the other, I feared to lose the ground I had already gained with so much toil and skill, and destroy all future hope by one rash effort, when time and patience might have won success. It was like setting my life upon the cast of a die, and yet I was ready to resolve upon the attempt. At any rate, I would entreat the explanation she had half promised to give me before. I would demand the reason of this hateful barrier, this mysterious impediment to my happiness, and, as I trusted, to her own. But while I considered in what manner I could best frame my request, my companion, wakened from her reverie with a scarcely audible sigh, and looking towards the window, where the blood-red harvest moon, just rising over one of the grim, fantastic evergreens, was shining in upon us, said, "Gilbert, it is getting late." "I see," said I. "You want me to go, I suppose?" "I think you ought. If my kind neighbors get to know of this visit, as no doubt they will not turn it much to my advantage." It was with what the vicar would doubtless have called a savage sort of smile that she said this. "Let them turn it as they will," said I. "What are their thoughts to you or me, as long as we are satisfied with ourselves and each other? Let them go to the deuce with their vile constructions and their lying inventions." This outburst brought a flush of colour to her face. "You have heard, then, what they say of me?" "I heard some detestable falsehood, but none but fools would credit them for a moment, Helen, so don't let them trouble you." "I do not think Mr. Millward a fool, and he believes it all. But however little you may value the opinions of those about you, however little you may esteem them as individuals, it is not pleasant to be looked upon as a liar and a hypocrite, to be thought to practice what you abhor, and to encourage the vices you would discountenance. To find your good intentions frustrated and your hands crippled by your supposed unworthiness, and to bring disgrace on the principles you profess. True. And if I, by my thoughtlessness and selfish disregard to appearances, have at all assisted to expose you to these evils, let me entreat you not only to pardon me, but to enable me to make reparation. Authorize me to clear your name from every imputation. Give me the right to identify your honor with my own and to defend your reputation as more precious than my life. Are you hero enough to unite yourself to one whom you know to be suspected and despised by all around you, and identify your interests and your honor with hers? Think, it is a serious thing. I should be proud to do it, Helen, most happy, delighted, beyond expression. And if that be all the obstacle to our union, it is demolished, and you shall be mine. And starting from my seat in a frenzy of ardor, I seized her hand and would have pressed it to my lips. But she as suddenly caught it away, exclaiming in the bitterness of intense affliction, "No, no, it is not all." "What is it, then?" "You promised I should know sometime, and—" "You shall know sometime, but not now." "My head aches terribly," she said, pressing her hand to her forehead, "and I must have some repose. And surely I have had misery enough today," she added, almost wildly. "But it could not harm you to tell it," I persisted. "It would ease your mind, and I should then know how to comfort you." She shook her head despondingly. "If you knew all, you too would blame me, perhaps even more than I deserve, though I have cruelly wronged you," she added, in a low murmur, as if she mused aloud. "You, Helen? Impossible." "Yes." "Not willingly, for I did not know the strength and depth of your attachment. I thought, at least I endeavored to think, your regard for me was as cold and fraternal as you professed it to be. Or as yours?" "Or as mine ought to have been, of such a light and selfish, superficial nature that—" "There, indeed, you wronged me." "I know I did. And sometimes I suspected it then, but I thought, upon the whole, there could be no great harm in leaving your fancies and your hopes to dream themselves to nothing, or flutter away to some more fitting object, while your friendly sympathies remained with me. But if I had known the depth of your regard, the generous, disinterested affection you seem to feel—" "Seem, Helen? That you do feel, then, I would have acted differently." "How?" "You could not have given me less encouragement, or treated me with greater severity than you did. And if you think you have wronged me by giving me your friendship, and occasionally admitting to me the enjoyment of your company and conversation, when all hopes of closer intimacy were vain, as indeed you always gave me to understand, if you think you have wronged me by this, you are mistaken. For such favors in themselves alone are not only delightful to my heart, but purifying, exalting, ennobling to my soul. And I would rather have your friendship than the love of any other woman in the world." Little comforted by this, she clasped her hands upon her knee, and glancing upward, seemed, in silent anguish, to implore divine assistance. Then turning to me, she calmly said, "Tomorrow, if you meet me on the moor about midday, I will tell you all you seek to know. And perhaps you will then see the necessity of discontinuing our intimacy. If indeed you do not willingly resign me as one no longer worthy of regard." "I can safely answer no to that. You cannot have such grave confessions to make. You must be trying my faith, Helen." "No, no, no," she earnestly repeated. "I wish it were so. Thank heaven," she added, "I have no great crime to confess. But I have more than you will like to hear, or perhaps can readily excuse, and more than I can tell you now, so let me entreat you to leave me." "I will. But answer me this one question first. Do you love me?" "I will not answer it." "Then I will conclude you do, and so good night." She turned from me to hide the emotion she could not quite control, but I took her hand and fervently kissed it. "Gilbert, do leave me," she cried, in a tone of such thrilling anguish that I felt it would be cruel to disobey. But I gave one look back before I closed the door and saw her leaning forward on the table, with her hands pressed against her eyes, sobbing convulsively. Yet I withdrew in silence. I felt that to obtrude my consolations on her then would only serve to aggravate her sufferings. To tell you all the questionings and conjectures, the fears and hopes, and the wild emotions that jostled and chased each other through my mind as I descended the hill, would almost fill a volume in itself. But before I was halfway down, a sentiment of strong sympathy for her I had left behind me had displaced all other feelings and seemed imperatively to draw me back. I began to think, why am I hurrying so fast in this direction? Can I find comfort or consolation, peace, certainty, contentment? All or anything that I want at home? And can I leave all perturbation, sorrow, and anxiety behind me there? And I turned round to look at the old hall. There was little besides the chimneys visible above my contracted horizon. I walked back to get a better view of it. When it rose in sight, I stood still a moment to look, and then continued moving towards the gloomy object of attraction. Something called me nearer, nearer still, and why not, pray? Might I not find more benefit in the contemplation of that venerable pile, with the full moon and the cloudless heaven shining so calmly above it, with that warm yellow luster peculiar to an August night, and the mistress of my soul within, than in returning to my home, where all comparatively was light and life and cheerfulness, and therefore inimical to me in my present frame of mind. And the more so that its inmates all were more or less imbued with that detestable belief, the very thought of which made my blood boil in my veins. And how could I endure to hear it, openly declared or cautiously insinuated? Which was worse? I had had trouble enough already with some babbling fiend that would keep whispering in my ear, it may be true, till I had shouted aloud, it is false, I defy you to make me suppose it. I could see the red firelight dimly gleaming from her parlour window. I went up to the garden wall and stood leaning over it, with my eyes fixed upon the lattice, wondering what she was doing, thinking, or suffering now, and wishing I could speak to her but one word, or even catch one glimpse of her before I went. I had not thus looked and wished and wondered long before I vaulted over the barrier, unable to resist the temptation of taking one glance through the window, just to see if she were more composed than when we parted. And if I found her still in deep distress, perhaps I might venture attempt a word of comfort, to utter one of the many things I should have said before, instead of aggravating her sufferings by my stupid impetuosity. I looked. Her chair was vacant, so was the room. But at that moment someone opened the outer door, and a voice, her voice, said, "Come out, I want to see the moon and breathe the evening air. They will do me good, if anything will." Here, then, were she and Rachel coming to take a walk in the garden. I wished myself safe back over the wall. I stood, however, in the shadow of the tall holly bush, which, standing between the window and the porch, at present screened me from observation, but did not prevent me from seeing two figures come forth into the moonlight. Mrs. Graham followed by another, not Rachel, but a young man, slender and rather tall. Oh heavens, how my temples throbbed. Intense anxiety darkened my sight. But I thought, yes, and the voice confirmed it. It was Mr. Lawrence. "You should not let it worry you so much, Helen," said he. "I will be more cautious in the future, and in time." I did not hear the rest of the sentence, for he walked close beside her and spoke so gently that I could not catch the words. My heart was splitting with hatred, but I listened intently for her reply. I heard it plainly enough. "But I must leave this place, Frederick," she said. "I can never be happy here, or anywhere else indeed," she added with a mirthless laugh. "But I cannot rest here." "But where could you find a better place," replied he, "so secluded, so near me, if you think anything of that?" "Yes," interrupted she, "it is all I could wish, if they could only have left me alone." "But wherever you go, Helen, there will be the same sources of annoyance. I cannot consent to lose you, I must go with you or come to you, and there are meddling fools elsewhere as well as here. While thus conversing, they had sauntered slowly past me, down the walk, and I heard no more of their discourse. But I saw him put his arm around her waist while she lovingly rested her hand on his shoulder. And then, a tremulous darkness obscured my sight. My heart sickened and my head burned like fire. I half rushed, half staggered from the spot where horror had kept me rooted, and leaped or tumbled over the wall, I hardly know which. But I know that afterwards, like a passionate child, I dashed myself on the ground and lay there in a paroxysm of anger and despair. How long? I cannot undertake to say. But it must have been a considerable time. For when, having partially relieved myself by a torment of tears, and looked up at the moon, shining so calmly and carelessly on, as little influenced by my misery as I was by its peaceful radiance, and earnestly prayed for death or forgetfulness, I had risen and journeyed homewards, little regarding the way, but carried instinctively by my feet to the door. I found it bolted against me, and everyone in bed except my mother, who hastened to answer my impatient knocking, and received me with a shower of questions and rebukes. "Oh, Gilbert, how could you do so? Where have you been? Do come in and take your supper. I've got it all ready, though you don't deserve it, for keeping me in such a fright. After the strange manner you left the house this evening, Mr. Millward was quite... Bless the boy, how ill he looks. Oh, gracious, what is the matter?" "Nothing, nothing. Give me a candle." "But won't you take some supper?" "No, I want to go to bed," said I, taking a candle and lighting it at the one she held in her hand. "Oh, Gilbert, how you tremble," exclaimed my anxious parent. "How white you look. Do tell me what it is. Has anything happened?" "It's nothing," cried I, ready to stamp with vexation because the candle would not light. Then, suppressing my irritation, I added, "I've been walking too fast, that's all. Good night." I marched off to bed, regardless of the "walking too fast, where have you been?" that was called after me from below. My mother followed me to the very door of my room with her questionings and advice concerning my health and my conduct, but I implored her to let me alone till morning, and she withdrew, and at length I had the satisfaction to hear her close her own door. There was no sleep for me, however, that night, as I thought, and instead of attempting to solicit it, I employed myself in rapidly pacing the chamber, having first removed my boots lest my mother should hear me. But the boards creaked, and she was watchful. I had not walked above a quarter of an hour before she was at the door again. "Gilbert, why are you not in bed? You said you wanted to go." "Confound it, I'm going," said I. "But why are you so long about it? You must have something on your mind." "For heaven's sake, let me alone, and get to bed yourself. Can it be that Mrs. Graham that distresses you so?" "No, I tell you it's nothing." "I wish to goodness it mayn't," murmured she, with a sigh, as she returned to her own apartment, while I threw myself on the bed, feeling most undutifully disaffected towards her for having deprived me of what seemed the only shadow of a consolation that remained, and chained me to that wretched couch of thorns. Never did I endure so long, so miserable a night as that, and yet it was not wholly sleepless. Towards morning my distracting thoughts began to lose all pretensions to coherency and shape themselves into confused and feverish dreams, and at length there followed an interval of unconscious slumber. But then the dawn of bitter recollection that succeeded, the waking to find life a blank, and worse than a blank, teeming with torment and misery, not a mere barren wilderness, but full of thorns and briars. To find myself deceived, duped, hopeless, my affections trampled upon, my angel not an angel, and my friend a fiend incarnate. It was worse than if I had not slept at all. It was a dull, gloomy morning. The weather had changed like my prospects, and the rain was pattering against the window. I rose, nevertheless, and went out, not to look after the farm, though that would serve as my excuse, but to cool my brain and regain, if possible, a sufficient degree of composure to meet the family at the morning meal without exciting inconvenient remarks. If I got a wetting that, in conjunction with a pretended overexertion before breakfast, might excuse my sudden loss of appetite. And if a cold ensued, the severer the better. It would help to account for the sullen moods and moping melancholy likely to cloud my brow for long enough. Good night.